The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all.
Alrighty, welcome to Secure in Mind. I recorded last week an episode with a former guest, Despin Espinou, for the second time, which is fantastic to catch up with someone who I admire good conversations with. And the same is going to be said for today's recording, which is with a former guest as well. His name is Neil Walsh. And again, love the conversation. Well, certainly the conversation that we had last time and the constant interaction. So without any further preamble, which is always my curse, I'll bring in Neil. Welcome, Neil.
Hi, Nick. As a former guest, I feel like I'm speaking from beyond the grave rather than speaking from Vienna, but here we are.
For the audience, I mean, you should have heard the banter before the recording button started. But I'm pretty sure that the quarantine is impacting people in many positive and negative ways. One great positive is that from my side, I've been able to focus on, say, cooking and exercising more because I have time to actually do the home gym. One of the negative sides, I've become slightly insane and starting to talk to some of the wardrobes, but I'm sick, I'm sorry.
Well, you've done exercise, I've become a morbidly obese alcoholic, so here we are. I guess mixing together. I mean, I was really disappointed. I bought a really nice new suit just before lockdown happened.
Yeah.
And I tried to put it on last week for a call that I had to be dressed up for. I can't get the trousers to close.
No.
And I would love to say it has shrunk in the wardrobe, but
sure.
No, it appears to be an expansion somewhere around my midline that's causing this, but there we are.
There you go. Well, the beard
looks the worst.
The beard looks like it's a George Clooney. So you're nailing it. You're nailing it from the neck up.
Nick, I can only assume that based on that assessment, that for breakfast you're having gin and tonic.
I'm a teetotaler. I'm a bloody vegan teetotaler who's lost 5 kilos.
God. Yeah. Self righteousness of this is amazing.
So with that, let's jump into it. I think we've got the foundation here. The last episode was a walk through Neil's background, because a lot of the podcast emphasis is on highlighting the actual people who do these amazing and very difficult and admirable jobs that do keep the world safe, secure. And yet now, since we've already done that piece and we're focusing more on some of the changes in risk consideration, security consideration that have arisen as a result of this changed world that we now are experiencing and sort of coming through the other side, but there are, that's going to be a long time coming to fully resolve or resolve in a different way. So Neil, I guess I'll turn it over to you, a quick update as to who you are and the position that you occupy. And I think the best thing to do would be to focus on several key points that you're looking at the moment in your charge, or as part of your charge. And certainly one of those areas, I think, which we could highlight is the webinar that you posted on Twitter and that I joined, which was United Nations webinar about predation increase and increase in some of the access to sites and other content that was being created by harming children and all that kind of that topic. So first things first, turn it over to you, a quick background, and we can jump into it.
Thanks, Nick. So, and good morning to everybody from Vienna on the day that we're recording this, Monday, the 18th of May. Mm-hmm. I'm Neil Walsh. I'm the head of the cybercrime and anti-money laundering section at the UN Office on Drugs and Crime based in Vienna. And prior to taking up this role 5 years ago, I worked for the UK's National Crime Agency based in Malta at the British High Commission there. Prior to that, at Europol, the EU law enforcement agency in The Hague. And prior to that, in London since 2000.
We've got a question. Why is it based in Malta?
So we were doing a lot of work on risks coming out of North Africa towards the EU, principally on the migration crisis back in 2015, and really looking at the risks to migrants and how to counter the organised crime element of that, of people who are putting people at enormous risk coming off the beaches of Libya towards Lampedusa in Italy or in towards Malta itself. And it was just, it was an easy location for us to work out of.
So that's a bit of background. There's an interesting development that's happening in Italy at the moment, which is to document illegal, but I guess the reference should be irregular, immigrants in southern Italy to harvest. Did you see that?
Yeah. No, I hadn't seen that.
Well, it's an interesting development. We'll see how that one plays out. The aim, I guess, is to also try and stop or at least mitigate some of the risks that they have in getting indoctrinated into the mafia controlled. I can't remember the Italian terminology for it, but the mafia controlled gangs.
I know what you're talking about, but the name escapes me. This is where we see organized crime exploiting, right? It'll exploit every possible opportunity that arises, whether there's a crisis or not.
Your vantage point as the global head of United Nations anti-money laundering, cybercrime, how has this changed? What are you seeing?
So if we look at the reason, first off, that we have cyber and money laundering in the same bit of the business are that they're the enablers of crime and terrorism. Mm-hmm. You need a device, you need cash or the ability to move cash value, however you choose to do that.
Yep.
And I guess it's unsurprising that we've seen criminality respond at an enormous pace during this, and terrorism as well. But we've looked, we've seen, for example, on the cyber side, we right back at the sort of middle of March when the quarantine really started to kick in around, certainly around the EU and beyond, we saw criminals on dark web markets who had never been there before, or dark web forums. So that encrypted part of the internet that you need to download another browser for, you kind of need to know a little bit about what you're doing. And we saw people going on to that saying, I've never done this before. I've never done crime in online. What's the area that I can make most money from during COVID-19?
Do you have percentages? Like, how much percentage increase or...?
No, there's been some statistics from some specialist cybersecurity companies looking at the child abuse online piece. But the biggest challenge with putting numbers around this, if you're looking at the dark web, there isn't a Google equivalent that crawls across everything. So you're only talking about a percentage of the stuff that you can see. And when you can't accurately scale the stuff that you can't see and don't know is there, then the numbers are a little bit, I guess they're a little bit inaccurate. And there's a risk that you say, we know this thing and we know that there's now five of this as opposed to one of this, which gives you some sense of scale of change, but it doesn't give you the broad overall picture.
And also, I guess, agencies, you've got private sector companies who are working hand in hand, sometimes with Intel or sometimes on active investigations, and they can't say that this onion address is open or not. Yeah.
So I think what we have seen is we've seen these occasions where criminals were looking for advice. Where could they make the most money? And back in the middle of March, that was from selling masks, antiviral masks.
Yeah.
We sort of, in UNODC, in the very early days of this, we managed to help disrupt a criminal enterprise to sell probably fictitious masks from sort of Eastern Asia to Europe via the Americas in a way that was going to undermine the ability of a government to respond to the crisis and the government, the country that was being horribly hit by it. I'm not going into the specifics because the investigation continues, but the ability for us to grab the right people at the right place very, very swiftly and have the right judicial actors talking together. That's very much our niche. And then only a couple of days later, we were contacted by UN Women, which is the UN's Female Empowerment Agency and the Gender Equality Agency. They had been running a webinar in one country, very much locally based on some local challenges. And about an hour into this webinar, suddenly there was a screen takeover and the image of a very, very young baby being live stream raped was broadcast. And so we've been doing a lot of work again very rapidly there to get an international investigation set up to help digital evidence to be acquired. And this sort of stuff has just gone on throughout the crisis. There has been a lot more criminality online. And the sort of position that we took from this, and we actually put out an assessment on this, which is available publicly, is looking at how cybercrime we predicted would grow. Okay, if you're stuck in your house, you can't go out, and you are used to being involved in crime, then you have to look at moving that online. And that's when we see those dark web chats of, okay, I've never done this before, how do I do it? Where do I make money? Right the way through to, we've all, you know, we've seen the scale of phishing attacks where you get that crappy email appears in your inbox, sometimes really obviously, sometimes very, very well done, where it's difficult to determine whether it's real or not. But we've seen that increase at really a scale, and I think that's around the world. And then I guess my biggest concern in all of this, and this applies to the money laundering side as well, where in the money laundering space, you're used to having fully functional financial intelligence units or the reporting sector. If you're a business, if you're a bank, if you're in the financial industry where you report suspicious transactions to, suddenly that's being done through people who are working remotely, who don't have access to their usual law enforcement or intelligence databases, or simply things get a bit slower or a bit clunkier. On the child abuse side, we've seen the takedown of websites with child abuse material becoming much, much slower around the world. And at the same time, the number of reports increasing dramatically. So you really see an increase in criminality. You see a drop in the law enforcement capability to respond because people are working from home. Law enforcers are also getting sick. And we've also seen the retasking of specialist, highly capable units to do quarantine enforcement or other work. So all of this comes together to make that sort of perfect storm of criminality. And then wrapped around all of that is the horrendous financial crisis that is starting, and given another few months, will have hit us globally in a way that we makes 2008 seem like a walk in the park.
Yeah. Perfect storm. We'll come on to the we'll move into the subject of child predation and the increased production of child abuse content. First things first, criminals entering the dark market or dark chat rooms, trying to ascertain how they can make money out of that. Are they trying to shift some of their traditional? Say, for example, they were a burglar and enterer. Are they trying to do, I don't know, how are they doing?
To say if it's just like, I'm bringing up something on my screen now that I can, want to read you. This was one of the comments on a dark market way back at the start was, and the title of the post was, "How do I make profit from the coronavirus?" Simple as that. On a known criminal marketplace, some clearly experienced criminals were coming back and saying, well, it's going to be stocks and shares, it's going to be reselling cryptocurrency assets, right the way through to loads of fraud. We saw a massive fraud increase. And I guess this is where the real message for the public, that if you're seeing something offered to you online and it feels too good to be true, then it probably bloody is, right? Yeah. Someone saying, I can sell you 50,000 masks for $20,000 or 10,000 euros or 5,000 euros, got to ask yourself, is this true? And if I go and pay my money, and if I pay it through cryptocurrency, through Western Union, through a bank transfer to, let's say, there's Nick in Milan, Neil in Vienna, but the account that you sent me to pay it to is based in another country, Gibraltar, in another location. There are things that will not make sense. We need to be fundamentally aware of those risks and take our own protective measures and increase, I think, really increase our level of awareness and our level of being judicious and cautious about this. Because we always see organized crime, and even crime that is not organized always seeks to exploit opportunities. And at a time and a scale like this, where people are at home, and for most people, they will feel, I think, a little bit more relaxed at home in terms of how they operate. We know, obviously, that there are people at home who have been highly, highly traumatized by this. Those who are now locked up with their abusers who can't escape from the normal challenges of daily life. But if we look at lots of people working from home now, if, for example, you're just working in a corporate environment or in government or in the UN, wherever, you would normally have an IT department who have got infrastructure wrapped around your kit to keep you safe from having your kit infected from malicious software or viruses. When you're sitting at home, that stuff doesn't work anymore because you're logging on directly through your own Wi-Fi or your own cable. So all of this stuff increased the vulnerability, and criminals are sitting there looking at, how do I best get into this? What do I do to make my money? How do I make an example of this? And most people who are then targeted probably aren't going to the police. And even if they do, we will face the challenge of a fully functioning criminal justice system.
How has the coordination amongst the different entities that you have to coordinate with on during regular days been? Has that been a smooth transition, a successful transition?
I think surprisingly, yes, it has been. Like everything, it takes a few days or a couple of weeks just to get into the flow of things, because whilst you're working at home, you've got to manage the rest of your life as well. Whether you're single and sitting at home and having to manage the horrible isolation of that with not having human contact, or if you're like me, I've got four kids, so trying to manage online schooling and the chaos of life that goes around that. But I think once everybody kind of got into a routine, some of the technological challenges we faced, where you have governments, international organizations, and others all using different platforms. So the platform that you and I are recording on today, then others mightn't be using that. Others are using Zoom, others are using Teams, others are using WebEx. And there was just those security challenges of, if you are from government and you have a device that is managed remotely, which has a lot of security lockdowns on it, then suddenly it was like, how do we actually do this? Is it on WhatsApp? Is it on Signal? Is it on Skype, whatever? But I think generally we got through that. We got through that quite quickly. And the broader challenges that we face with doing work online within the UN is that some stuff has to happen face-to-face to make it legal. So things that happen in the UN General Assembly or the Security Council, often they have to be physical meetings to meet a specific legal mandate for that to be a formal meeting.
Can you see that shifting out of necessity?
It's a really interesting question. Yeah. I think there is where you will see different challenges with some countries. So some countries do not wish virtual meetings to be formal, as we call it, which is sort of a legal mandate comes from it, or a legal decision. Others do. And then the challenge will be, okay, well, how do you square that particular circle? Because we've got to keep talking. The whole point of international diplomacy is you get things done by talking. And yes, we can do stuff like this, but if some countries don't want this to be a formal thing, how does that happen? Because you aren't going to see people getting on planes and traveling to New York or Vienna or Geneva, I don't think, for the rest of this year, certainly not until way into the fourth quarter. I see challenges with lots of countries hearing that their international flights aren't going to start to operate again until December. So if you're sitting in, I don't know, let me pick one, Australia, and you're supposed to come to a meeting in Vienna or in New York, how does that physically happen? If you can't go, then does that mean that your locally based diplomat has to cover that for you? Or can you participate online? And if you participate online, does that then mean that this whole thing...
Does that constitute as a formal meeting?
Exactly. So all of these things we're trying to work through. Some of the bigger challenges are translation. So a lot of UN meetings are normally done in the six UN languages. So how do you do that remotely? It's become really difficult. We're still working through the tech on how to do it. Because you can do some bits, but what happens if the tech falls over and you don't know? How does the interpreter suddenly say, I didn't catch that, or are you speaking too quickly? All of these
and tech probably isn't bound by the same legal obligations as the translators would be, no?
So some of it can or can't be. A lot of it comes down to how that meeting is constituted. If the chair and the member states, the countries involved, say, this is cool, this is formal, even if we're doing it remotely, that's grand. The challenge is, if you're trying to participate in this remotely from another country, and you're listening in another UN language than whatever the meeting is being officially spoken in, if suddenly you lose that, how do you let someone know that it's dropped off? Because if we're sitting in Vienna or in New York, you simply stick your hand up and start waving furiously at the interpreters, or they're waving at you. But if this has gone off and then you've got lots of people trying to talk over each other, it just the mechanism of doing that becomes pretty tough.
Absolutely. Plenty of things to iron out. Well, let's we don't have huge amounts of time, so I'd like to direct us toward the one of the primary issues that you're looking at is abuse, and we can sort of split that into two areas, which is the general domestic abuse
and violence that has increased. And we can sort of look at some of the figures, statistics, and what UNODC is doing with local and international partners, and then also the child abuse issue. And again, yeah, the similar thing. So back to you.
So on the child abuse side, it has sadly and predictably grown significantly, where we have one specialist partner who we work with, I'll give them a shout out, called WebIQ. They have seen like a 200-300% increase on dark web marketplaces of child abuse material. Okay. To make it clear, when we talk child abuse material, we're talking sexual content under the age of 18. What we see from a number of partners like the Internet Watch Foundation is on the normal, open, clear internet, around 50% of child abuse material now is self-generated. So that means a child with a smartphone or a tablet taking sexualized imagery of themselves and sharing it online. Now, sometimes that will be between consenting partners, albeit below the age of consent, sharing images of each other, sexual images.
Which then get released to the public through breach or...
Could be a breach, or it could just be where a relationship is broken down and the other partner then shares that as a method of either extorting or sexually extorting or just generally being a dick, frankly, if I want to put it like that.
Yep.
And the problem is that they often don't recognize that they might be committing really serious criminal offenses.
Space.
Message to anybody, if you share sexual content with somebody, it could be across a mobile app, it could be on an online app, you've really got to hopefully have that agreement in place that is between each other. Even if a relationship breaks down, you're not going to go and share that with somebody else, because if you do, you're highly likely to be committing a criminal offense. If you do that and you're under the age of 18, there is a risk that you are actually becoming, or you get labeled as, a child sexual offender in that space. We really don't want that to be happening. But if we take it to the worst end of this, Nick, and this was the stuff that something in my previous life that I dealt with a lot, is the targeting and sexual exploitation and rape of very, very young children, right the way through to babies and infants. And there's not one or two of these things happening. It's happening all the time. It's happening in every country, and it's accessed in every country. So the challenges are where, and certainly where we've seen criminals who are now, and it is typically men, not exclusively, but it is typically men abusing children, often their own children. So that's what we're seeing increase during this point in time. If you are locked down at home with your own children, they then become your target. They become your target victims. So I guess there's a number of things that we have to be aware of in this illness. First off, if you are someone who is listening to this podcast, if you have found yourself, if you find that you are sexually attracted to children, there is help available before this becomes a criminal investigation and you end up getting arrested and charged. And there is a campaign called the Stop It Now campaign run by the Lucy Faithful Foundation. You can Google it, find the link, and they can provide help, counseling, advice to people who do find their own sexual behavior worrying and troubling. And that there are a number of different types of resource like this out there. Equally, if you have come across child abuse material on the internet, if you have, for example, been looking at an adult porn site, or you have been looking to find that, and it doesn't take much to go from a few clicks to suddenly start finding younger material, which then suddenly starts to look at, hey, that doesn't look like an adult involved. If you find this, please report it, because you can report it anonymously. You don't need to go to the police, but if you go, for example, to InHope, InHope, search them for their InHope reporting portal or the Internet Watch Foundation reporting portal, all you simply do is you upload the URL, the hyperlink that you landed on, and you can explain how you found it. And I can send you something on this, Nick, so you've got the details.
Yeah, if you can send me the link, I'll put them in the show notes. Yeah.
Thank you. Then you can simply report that, and then that material tends to get taken down quite rapidly, because behind all child abuse material, there is a real victim. And we see there's a number of Twitter feeds from former child abuse victims who are now adults who still see their abuse, their rape, their torture being shared routinely online. So anything we can do to help take that down, help someone to stop being continually abused. And that allows law enforcers to focus on those highest risk individuals, those who are generating new material of their own children or children that they have access to right now, because those are the priority cases to get involved in.
And I think that it's a really important message for a topic that, quite frankly, no one wants to talk about, which is extremely relevant, but not talking about it is being an ostrich sticking your head in the sand and then and then persecuting. And this is the kicker. This is the really contentious part, which I think is what you're saying is, if someone does have that attraction to children, they can actually stop it prior to acting on their urges. And I was listening to another podcast, just as fate would have it, Sam Harris, wildly popular neuroscientist, philosopher, and he was chatting to a bloke about the fact that pretty much everything in this life is dished out via luck, right? You don't choose to be born into a family with certain socioeconomic level and certain brain mechanics happening. You don't choose that. It's basically luck. And anything that you attribute as to your success or your devious nature, it's a lot of the time not, but it's kind of it's the fate of your existence in that time. And then potentially you can craft and hone and develop some of these other characteristics. But even then, those characteristics defined by the condition that you were brought into existence. So the level of chutzpah that you have, it's kind of predefined anyway. It can be, and this is, it's a contentious argument because it spills into philosophy and whether there is fate and, and religious definition. But the point is, if you do see that someone has a problem, but they have an urge, and yet you can stop that urge and you can encourage them to get help and mitigate that, that's far better than sweeping it under the carpet and letting it rot.
Yeah, and I think that this is where it's so important that in the work that we do, there is a load of research that is done by philosophers, by social scientists, by psychologists, criminologists. Everybody has to bring some sight to this and understanding, especially of the more challenging problems. And I guess it's a good opportunity to try and dispel one of the myths. One of the myths that we often hear is that if you are abused as a child, you then become a child abuser. Total and utter crap. There is no supportive evidence of that whatsoever. But where we do see correlational links, and a correlation doesn't give you cause or effect. There is no statistical significance behind it. But there are correlations between children who are subject of violence at a young age and in the home, then going on to offend later in life. And some of the research that's going on is looking at basically saying you break that child at the very beginning, and it's exceptionally hard to recover that child if they're kept within a violent environment growing up. So I guess the message for all of us there is that where we see violence in the home, where we have any evidence of that happening, we really ought as a society to try and do something to mitigate that and not just turn our heads and think, that's a bit unpleasant. I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to see that. And it's the same with any crime or any behavior that creates risk. People have to step up sometimes. And if you know, sometimes you look at if a terrorist attack happens, there's the 10-80-10 phenomenon of 10% of people will see, hear a bomb going off and run away. 10% of people will run towards it to help. 80% will freeze. So it's trying to, you can address your own behavior. You can get involved and try and stop things. And that's being a little bit more cognizant of the world around you and not just seeing the colleague who you work with who has bruises all the time and seems to walk into walls or doors, or the child who turns up at school in a state every day. And that's where, you know, this isn't a law enforcement solution. I say this all the time. By the time it has reached law enforcement, the shit's already happened. What do we do to prevent? How do we get into a much better prevention space where we create the space for victims to come forward, to be believed, where we stop people committing violence in the home? And this is principally male, right? We often hear the term violence against women, and I personally hate that term because it is violence caused by men.
Right? you just dropped the active verb in that, which is the man.
And there's a fascinating psychologist and researcher called Dr. Jessica Eaton, or Dr. Jessica Taylor, changed her name recently, and her work looking at how victim blaming, how women are blamed, is fascinating. It's really made me rethink just the way that we talk and the way that we use language, and how that we can blame unconsciously by just having language the wrong way, in the same way that we recruit. We recruit by having, you know, we have typically male nouns and verbs in recruitment adverts, then it is fundamentally off-putting for female candidates. And we just got to reassess how we do stuff. And as a society, look at how we really get towards equality. We talk about having, you know, we're here for gender equality.
Yeah.
If we don't change how we do stuff, then we're not really addressing that issue at all.
Yeah, and this, well, there's two pieces to what I'm going to say. Last week when I spoke to Despina, we were talking about the change in title from European Union, a way of life as protection of the way of life, to promotion. And with the you know, whether you could label it as semantics and the choice of word, it actually has a profound impact on the view of what you're trying to achieve. Now, another thing that I was thinking of, it's very, and you would love this TEDx talk from a guy called Jackson Katz. I'm not sure whether you've heard it, but it's violence against women. It's a men's issue. That's the YouTube or the TEDx. I'll put in the links for everyone. It says exactly that. A lot, you know, a big part is grammar and how grammar can actually model. By shifting the active into the passive voice, all of a sudden the passive voice almost falls off. So he turns it around from, you know, John beat Mary, and then Mary was beaten by John, and then it's easy in a newspaper article to say Mary is a battered woman. The, you know, the victim, where's John? Where's John in that sentence? Quite.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's when we start to apply this to all areas of criminality, we start to get a different view of how it plays out.
Yeah.
The same as saying in a lot of organized crime, women are typically perceived as the victims, and they often are. But we miss that research on women as organized criminals.
Yeah.
And we had a fascinating talk at UN in Vienna last year, where a woman who is now a criminologist out of a university in California, and she used to be working as an organized criminal on the Mexico-US border, involved in smuggling kids and drugs across the border.
Mm.
And just listening to her, how she was able to do stuff, because law enforcement tends not to look at female criminals, or make an assumption, and there might be an unconscious assumption there, or it might be, okay, well, we'll look at the guy because it's got to be him. So
she was coerced.
How do we address?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's loads of stuff, and I think loads of areas for research that needs to continue to go on, and what we ought to be looking at sort of post COVID-19 or whatever the new world looks like at the end of this. How has that changed criminality? How do we address law enforcement? How do we move from taking those, you know, those low-hanging fruit, to coin the phrase that I hate, to looking at those more impactive organized crime investigations, where you go after targets of choice, not targets of opportunity, and looking at disruption? And I think that all of it makes us reassess how the process of crime operates.
So I'm not too sure how much time you've got left, but I do have one big question that's sort of sitting on my mind and many other people's minds who are looking at emerging tech and say, you know, a content tracing app. Now that's, you know, slightly innocuous there, although it has, you know, potentially very, you know, severe surveillance ramifications and setting a path. Your mention of people being able to turn not a blind eye, but at least an excused eye, right, for bruises when coming to school. Well, it might have been the door. It might have been, okay? And there's enough of a, you know, there's enough leeway to say that it might have been. What about in your vision, the application of technology in a sense where, you know, give it 10 years, 20 years time, we'll have implantables to measure the heart rate, to measure these different physiological characteristics of a body showing stress, showing severe stress, showing trauma, and then using those in a law enforcement sense or in a child protection sense. There are many, many arguments against that from a privacy, and understandable and arguments against that from a privacy surveillance perspective. What are the kind of discussions that are happening at the moment, and is that a reality that we are sort of looking at, and therefore what protections are in place at the beginning?
So I guess we have to look at how crime is investigated, and the point that I always seek to put across is that any investigative measure has to be proportionate. legal, accountable, and necessary. And those four key premises can be based in law. And if you look within the EU, there is a test for necessity. If I put my old geek head on, I think it's silver. And the EU was the stated case on that, and looking at what is necessity within a democratic society. Mm-hmm. And it's the old adage of sledgehammer to crack a nut. So if I was explaining this to my kids the other day, my eldest, she's 9, and she was asking about policing and when I used to be in it and what do you do? And I said, well, let's imagine you go into the shop here and you steal a chocolate bar. Would it be proportionate? So what does proportionate mean? So, well, is it right that the measure of what we do to investigate this? Would it be proportionate for me to put a camera into your house to wiretap your mobile phone? She doesn't have a mobile phone. She's not getting a mobile phone until she's 47. would it be proportionate to have a surveillance team for that? Well, no, clearly not. And we just have to keep applying that because... Yeah. Tech is a problem, right? Without doubt. There will be some real issues and challenges that we see all the time with tech.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean don't do it, but it means security by design. And there's a great advocate for this based in Australia called Julian Mangrant, who's the e-safety commissioner for Australia. And Julie used to work for Twitter, for Facebook, Microsoft. So she's seen both sides of this. And I think when we look at the tracing apps, there is the irony that for cybersecurity, for a long, old time, we've been saying, turn off your geolocation, turn off your Bluetooth unless you need to use them. Now the message is, do please turn them on. and there are certainly, I think there are real privacy issues in this. There are real privacy risks that need to be mitigated. Mm. But there is no one size fits all. It will depend on the country, on the democracy or not that you live in, whether your country will gather that. And we saw, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, we saw the Supreme Court of Israel
That was a big one.
Expressing concern, which I thought was really good to see the court stepping into that space. Mm. When you have your domestic intelligence agency, Shin Bet, is charged with gathering this data, that the courts express some concern. Mm. And that's great. That's how courts should be acting.
The courts should function,
So we need oversight. It's proportionate. It's legal. There has to be a basis in law.
Yeah.
And we can't just talk about everything being okay because it has a basis in law. That law has to be good. And it cannot be a legal state overreach. So it's about getting all of this in place. And I think there are lots of emergency measures being made under COVID-19 that are entirely proportionate and legal and accountable and necessary. However, what I don't see us having now is what is that de minimis limit? At what point do we say these are no longer proportionate or these are no longer necessary? Where is the judicial parliamentary oversight to allow us to make those decisions? And then when we look at how that tech rolls out, at what point do you or I as a consumer have the ability to turn this thing off? And when we look at how if an app is poorly configured or an operating system update is poorly configured, that then compromises that entire device. What does that thing have access to that says a lot about you? Because let's face it, these devices, they're in our pockets 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They know everything about us. So I think there's lots of questions that need to be asked here, a lot of robust investigation and challenge that need to be offered by academics, by NGOs, by government, by the press on how things are playing out.
And that ain't easy because you've got ecosystems that are basically treating the human population in the like test subjects. No one really asked to download Facebook, but it kind of became the norm. And Facebook now, through its algorithms, is able to model some of our behavior, some of our interests, some of our democratic decisions even. And so the horse has run away. The cart is over there. And we're left with a system which more, half the population uses. But we didn't ask for that. We were given that, and it was just kind of a rigged choice because everyone else was using it.
But there is the irony, right, where... we see some of the arguments on not using the COVID tracing apps, and those arguments are playing out on Facebook. Like, hold on, you've got Facebook, or you've got.
It is.
No matter which brand it is, you've downloaded the thing where you click the button where, I'm okay with those terms and conditions. Yeah. Where I think I might have mentioned this in the previous podcast with you, Nick, where there's an app for the next underground train in Vienna.
Yeah.
And you download the app, and the first thing it says is the app would like access to your contacts.
Yeah.
Bugger off. I want you to tell me what the next train time is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's the monetization, because people have to make money to build their thing and develop and sell.
Yeah.
So we all have a decision to make in this, and it isn't all on government, and it isn't all bad either. I mean, I'm wearing I won't mention the brand, but I'm wearing a fitness-based watch on my wrist right now. And as you know, I've been going through cancer treatment for the past 2 years and the past couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I looked at the app and I looked at my heart rate, and it turned out my heart rate was doing something mental during the night when I was asleep. So we've now been able to work out where I had a probable electrical imbalance caused by a problem of nutrition, caused by a problem of an intestine that doesn't work anymore, all because my watch was noticing at 3 o'clock in the morning that suddenly my heart rate was reaching 180 beats a minute.
Wow.
And trust me, there is nothing in my life that makes my heart rate reach that at 3 o'clock in the morning. So there are good and bad in this, and there isn't going to be a clear line between it.
Mm.
And it comes back to that proportionality and that necessity and that overview of democracy and the ability of a people to say, yeah, we're okay with this, or no, we're not. And then the problem, the challenge for tech companies is, if the overall premise of people is, yeah, we're not happy with that, what do? Do they just say, well, screw you, we're going to keep going anyway?
Yeah.
Or is there a mechanism in place to challenge that?
Mm. Well, these are the questions that we have. Look, I'd like to end on a final point. I follow you on social media, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and something that
I apologize on behalf of.
Look, it's a wild ride, but for the listeners out there, I urge you to follow Neil, because not only do you and I sincerely mean this. I mean, it's admirable, your background, the human story, and what you do at the moment, coordinating amongst all the globally in what you do, but also your personal story about surviving bowel cancer and being, it's almost, I mean, you know, the same kind of personality which wants to unmask the horrific crimes of potential child abuses and say, well, let's not let this get to that stage. We'll unmask it first, because that's easy to rip off the Band-Aid. I see that as the same really courageous personality trait of yours, which is to say, well, I got bowel cancer, I'll be public about it, and all the shit that I'm going through, the trials, tribulations, and the successes, I find it remarkable. And if there are any other links or shout-outs that you want, I'll pop them in the show notes as well.
That's really hard. I don't know what to say to that, really. I'm an incredibly lucky person. I see myself as that I've, cancer, which for now seems to be probably gone. Fingers crossed, we're only 2 years in.
Mm.
And that leaves you with various hangovers. My liver isn't working properly at all. We're not quite clear how to fix that yet.
That could be the booze. That could be the booze.
I wish that was the case. There's that. There are my lungs don't function properly anymore. They've been damaged by pulmonary embolisms after surgery.
Mm.
I had a brain hemorrhage during surgery, which means that my right ear doesn't work so well, which is a great excuse for not hearing things at home. But you take all of this, you think, I'm still alive. My life is bloody fine compared to what lots of other people are going through.
People
who have lost their jobs during this, people who have had lots of family members die during this.
Yeah.
People who, you know, there's a lady I know who I've got, I've got an enormous amount of respect for her, doesn't even come close. But who was sexually abused, tortured, kidnapped, and raped as a teenager. And Alicia, I'll put the link to you, put her story up there. Alicia is an astoundingly strong individual to have been through all of this stuff. So when we talk about child abuse, she's the person who's been through that. She doesn't see herself as a victim, but she's been a victim and an advocate. And how do you take this stuff and turn it around? You either let it destroy you, or you say, well, okay, that's my lot. These are the cards that I have been dealt.
Yeah.
And I'm going to crack on and deal with it. And the fact that people like you give us the opportunity to talk about it and try and put a message out there, that you hope that for everything that we do in things like this, that there's one person who listens and thinks, oh, Christ, I think that might be that thing, and then takes action on it.
Yeah.
And this is that's the biggest secret of development. No one knows of development, of prevention, how it works or how you measure that.
Yeah.
And I keep saying this to the people who fund our work. I said, some of this stuff you're not going to be able to put a number on an Excel sheet about. And we're just going to have to go with it and hope that it has an impact somewhere at some point in time. And that's why the work that you do, Nick, when people reach out and they listen, then it does have an impact. So thank you.
Well, thank you too, mate. It's been an absolute privilege as always.
Likewise.
Stay safe, stay well, stay at home. for the foreseeable
future. I'm doing all of those things. Yes.
And we'll talk to you next time.
All right. Take care. And thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Bye.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all.